Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Take our latest 10-question demographics quiz and see how well you know our area. Question one, which local county has the highest median income? See if you can answer all 10 questions about the demographics of the New York area. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Now, the Supreme Court released several opinions this morning as it winds down the session for this year. A big one out today says that people who signed a petition to repeal Washington State's gay rights law do not have the right to keep their names secret from the public. Again, people who signed a petition to repeal Washington State's gay rights law do not have the right to keep their names secret from the public. A public petition is public. Another ruling has to do with the Honest Services Law. The court has sided with former Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling in limiting the use of a federal fraud law, which has been a favorite of white-collar crime prosecutors. So we'll get into those rulings as well as this past Monday's ruling in favor of the government's position that it should be a crime to provide material support to foreign terrorist organizations, even if that support is for non-terrorist peaceful activities. This has civil rights advocates claiming that this violates our First Amendment rights. It's the High Court's first ruling on free speech and association rights in the context of terrorism since 9/11. And we'll preview next week's Elena Kagan confirmation hearings, which start on Monday. All of this with Dahlia Lithwick, Supreme Court watcher and senior editor at Slate. Hey, Dahlia, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. I feel like you've just done the whole segment.
Well, there's so much that the court has done this week, but not really. I'm still actually quite confused. So tell us about Doe versus Reed on anonymous ballot petitions.
Such an interesting case, Brian. I actually wrote about it earlier this week because there's this new trend in, particularly in the gay rights context, where folks who oppose gay rights and particularly gay marriage have made claims in the wake of Proposition 8 in California. And you'll remember after Prop 8, there was real retaliation to folks who had pushed for Prop 8. And so this was a follow-on case to that that came out of Washington State, where there was a ballot petition to get an initiative onto the ballot that would have done away with the state's statute that was going to give everything but marriage rights to gay couples. And the folks who signed that petition said, all 138 of us want our signatures not disclosed because we're afraid of retaliation. We're afraid that we're going to get harassed. We're going to get threatened. There's going to be economic retaliation in our workplaces. And the court today, 8-1, said, nope. This is a public matter. Your signatures are public, and you don't get to hide them. The court left open the possibility that the kinds of people who are afraid of their signatures going public can still petition the state and say, look, there's an exemption to the release of these statutes if you're genuinely afraid. But the court said, and I should add that Clarence Thomas was the lone dissenter, you just don't have a First Amendment right to shield your name from public disclosure.
Who do you think this is going to affect most of all going forward, or what kinds of politics?
Well, you know, this is an interesting foot in the door case. If you'll remember when the Citizens United case came down and there was a disclosure provision, a public disclosure provision that was actually upheld, it was Clarence Thomas who dissented saying, no, people shouldn't have to disclose who they contribute to because they're subject to all kinds of retaliation. So this, in some sense, was the thin edge of the wedge. This is an attempt to start to make the case. Apparently, they haven't sold it to anyone but Clarence Thomas, that when you take unpopular positions, be it signing a ballot initiative, be it advocating for Prop 8, or be it contributing to unpopular parties in elections, you're subject to such excruciating retaliation that you should get to keep that information private. And so I think that this is, you know, there was some hope that there was momentum for this argument to get some traction at the court. As I said, based on Clarence Thomas's, you know, one vote in the campaign finance context and then one vote today, I don't know that there's a lot of people on the court who are persuaded that the kind of retaliation that you could face for espousing unpopular positions is sufficient to keep your name private.
Let's get into the so-called honest law rulings today, and there are actually three of them. One sided with former Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling, another sided with former newspaper magnate Conrad Black, people who, you know, generally folks love to hate. So what did the former Enron CEO actually win today?
Well, Skilling probably won a fairly pyrrhic victory. It's not clear from the court's decision that this is going to make an enormous difference in his sentence. But this honest services law essentially enshrines a very, very vague right that the public has to honest services. And what the court said today in the ruling is that the parts of Skilling's conviction that flow from that honest services statute, it's just the statute as construed was too broad. And so what the court said today was, look, there is an honest services law, but we're going to limit it to bribery and kickbacks, and that what Skilling was convicted of was much, much broader than that. But in effect, what the court said, and this was an opinion written by Justice Ginsburg, there's lots of concurrences and dissents, and it's 144 pages, Brian, maybe not lunch reading. But essentially what the court says is that not any scheme, just any old scheme that deprives anyone of honest services is going to be sufficient under this statute, that it's got to be limited to cases of bribery and kickbacks. So that essentially what the court did was threw this back to this Court of Appeals, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and said, look at this again. To the extent that this affects Skilling's sentence, you've got to re-instruct the jury and make sure that you've narrowed the honest services statute. It does, as you said, affect Conrad Black probably far more. He's got a 6.5-year sentence that may be now in question. Again, that's for the Court of Appeals to revisit. The other interesting thing I'll just note about the Skilling case is that there was another prong of his appeal where he said, I couldn't possibly have had a fair trial in Houston, in crazy post-Enron Houston. The pretrial publicity tainted the jurors. The court rejected that claim by a vote of 6-3.
So I'm curious, if bribery and kickbacks are the only things that can now get you prosecuted under a law requiring honest services, what are some of the big acts of dishonesty that are now legal?
Well, it's an interesting question. It certainly means that this vague kind of cooking of the books or disclosing of inaccurate information that happened here to third parties is certainly looks like it's now not considered part of this honest services prosecution. And as you said in your introduction, prosecutors have really used this. They used it in the Blago case. They've really, I think, been very, very intent on using the broadest possible construction that, in effect, anybody who's hurt by your dishonest services is now has a claim. So I think that it's unclear what exactly is off the table, but it's very clear, I think, to the court. And this was, I should add, the court was very, very concerned at oral argument in Skilling and Black that just accidents, mere mistakes or missteps or misunderstandings of the law should not get all swept in under this idea of honest services. So I think the court was really, really trying to narrow it because they felt that anybody could accidentally violate the honest services statute as it was construed.
It's almost the end of June, which means almost the end of the term for the Supreme Court. Are we awaiting any big decisions still?
Yes, and the court said today that they would end the term on Monday. So Monday morning at 10, we get the last of the decisions. And then, as you know, the Elena Kagan's hearings start at 12:30 on Monday. So it's going to be a hopping day. Still outstanding, one of the most important cases of the term, which is this Chicago gun case. That's asking the question whether the D.C. gun case that the court heard several years ago would be incorporated against the state so that the Second Amendment right to bear arms that was enshrined in that Heller case would now apply with equal force to all the states. And there's another interesting case that everybody's been waiting for that has to do with patent law. That's coming down. That's the Bilski case. And another third really interesting case that we're awaiting that has to do with whether Christian groups on campuses can be forced to accept members who say that they're gay when that violates the group's own vision of what it seeks to do.
Right. So several gay rights-related decisions coming down here at the end of June from the Supreme Court. All right, listeners, we have a little Elena Kagan nomination, confirmation hearings, listener participation participation opportunity for you now. So listen up. The Sunlight Foundation has created this tool that lets you browse through Elena Kagan's emails sent during her time in the Clinton administration. So we're going to make this available to you on our website, and we're inviting you to go poke around and see if you find anything that could indicate what kind of Supreme Court justice she would be. You can search for terms like in any inbox. You know, the search function is there. The site is elenasinbox.com. We have a link, but it's elenasinbox.com. There's everything from her making lunch plans to official business about appropriations. So tell us what you find on our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, and we'll try to talk about it next week during our coverage of the hearings. So, Dahlia, I'm curious, as somebody who watches the Supreme Court and these nominations closely, do you have any searches you think people might try or things to look out for in those emails?
So certainly the document dumps that we've seen suggest that people may want to poke around and look at her advice that she gave with respect to the partial birth abortion ban that was then something that President Clinton was struggling whether or not he was going to support it. She's got some interesting statements about the NRA. She compares them to the KKK and calls them, quote, bad guy organizations. Interesting stuff in there if you search her position on the crack cocaine and sentencing disparity. She urges that the administration try to limit that disparity because of its racial implications. So I think what you get when you look through these and do these searches is yet again a sense of Kagan as somebody who's trying to sort of bring everyone to the table. She's very savvy about tactics and politics. I think she's generally spot on about the law, but she's kind of that and more. She's really a tactical advisor and a very practical advisor to the president. And so it's worth sort of poking around just to get a sense of her tone, this attempt to build consensus, and this just very, very realistic, pragmatic approach to even very, very complicated constitutional questions.
So there you go. There are some suggestions for ways you might search and use this tool that the Sunlight Foundation has created to let you browse through Elena Kagan's emails sent during her time in the Clinton administration, which have now been made public. So listeners, pick a search term or several and go poke around. We have a comments page for this. And if you find anything interesting, we'll talk about it during our show next week, during our coverage of the Elena Kagan confirmation hearings. We have a link on our page, but again, the Sunlight Foundation's web address for this is elenasinbox.com. And Dahlia, before you go, you know, she's described Supreme Court confirmation hearings as a vapid, hollow charade. You're on board with that description, I think, in general. Is it going to be that next week?
I think that she's going to be scrutinized probably more closely, Brian, than some of the nominees we've seen, only because she's not a judge and she doesn't have the kind of paper record that gives a sense of how she looks at the law. And so I think what we have is a lot of emails, as we just discussed. We have her conduct when she was dean at Harvard. But I think there's a real question about what kind of judge she will be, and we don't have good answers for that. And so I think it will be very probing in ways that maybe we didn't see as much of at the Sotomayor hearing last year. But I do think she is so deft on her feet. She is so very, very smart that she will find new and fascinating and compelling ways to tell the committee that she can answer their questions.
I'll mention that WNYC.org will offer a live stream of the entire confirmation hearings when they begin next week, and we'll be airing excerpts live on our show in the mornings as well. And we thank Dahlia Lithwick, Supreme Court watcher and senior editor at Slate, for breaking down today's rulings and looking forward to the Kagan confirmation hearings. And Dahlia, maybe we'll talk to you next week.
I hope so, Brian. Be well.
Thanks a lot. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, summer activities in the New York area where you are the doer, not the spectator. 118 games of tennis, anyone? Stay with us.